Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. For the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, oh, and Papa they have. God bless the child that's got his own. He's got his own. The bread and such. You can help yourself, but darling, don't you take too much. Mama may have, oh, and Papa may have.
That's Olita Adams accompanying herself on piano with God Bless the Child, a torch song written and first sung by Billie Holiday. It's from her 1995 album, Moving On. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday. It is February the 17th, and our guest, Professor Charles L. Lumpkins, returns to of his presentation, Black Labor from the War to the Turn of the 21st Century. And because there's so much information that is being shared, and always when you get a gift, you ought to know it. So I had a gift of this college-level quality information from Dr. Lumpkins, and we embrace it and thank the University of Labor and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University, where he earned his doctorate in 2006. And he teaches history, science. His scholastic research focuses particularly on the history of the working class. He is the author of the highly praised American Pogrom, The East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. It's a necessary historical reference, I would tell you, for the state of affairs in Ferguson, Missouri today. And with that, thank you, Dr. Lumpkin.
Hello,
with us once more.
Hi, Eutrice.
I'm so delighted that... Yeah.
I'm having difficulties with audio.
Okay. Well, what we will do is contact you by phone, and we will proceed with that. Is that all right?
That's fine with me.
Okay, great. So expect a call from the engineer. He will call you on the phone, and we'll hook up and proceed. This is one. So anticipate a call any minute now, and
okay,
you can
hi.
Close it. Okay.
Hello.
So, where are you going to be taking us today?
Okay. First of all, should I get off of Skype?
What you should do is kill off your Skype.
Okay. It's off now. The echo is gone. Very good.
Okay, are we set up?
Okay, are we? Okay, I hear you now.
Very good. So the forces may conspire, but we can overcome them, no matter what.
That's right. So, that's right.
So where are you taking us today?
Okay, well, I agreed to start with the end of the World War One era and try to move as quickly as possible to today, at least what I originally said, to the 1960s of the Civil Rights Movement, Black Power Politics era of the 1960s. I just want to recap what I've said in the previous, the general theme, overarching theme in the previous interviews, namely that I want to say that black labor history shows that, like all working people in the United States, and I'm sure it's true around the world, that black workers want, you know, decent working conditions, good pay, benefits, but most of all, dignity at the workplace. And that dignity at the workplace would be translated to dignity across society, since the vast majority of Americans, including African Americans, are working people. And the other major theme I want to stress is that I see black labor, black workers' activities as part of the African American freedom struggle. Usually we think of civil rights, the civil rights movement, as the freedom struggle movement. It's only one part of the overall African American freedom struggle. Now, of course, people have debated hard and long and fiercely over what is the freedom struggle, how it should manifest, and so forth. But I'll leave that up to people who want to debate those niceties. But I just want to say that the whole idea of the history of black labor is part of the African American freedom movement, the African American freedom struggle to achieve freedom and justice, racial equality, especially in the economic and political arenas. Okay, well, picking up on the end of World War One, which was a very revolutionary movement around the world. Of course, there was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 and involved working people. There were revolutions in Germany and Hungary and elsewhere that failed, but nonetheless, working people were very much involved in one form or another. And in the United States, we have working people involved, not so much perhaps as far as making a stab at revolution, but nonetheless making a stab to hold on to the gains they have won during the World War One years, including black workers. Namely, they want higher pay, union recognition, things like that. But it was a big moment for the power elites, whether they're industrialists, whether they're plantation owners, whatever, to turn the clock back before World War One. So we saw a huge rise in the number of lynchings, mass anti-black violence, mass violence against workers in general, and of course targeted groups of people like industrial workers of the world and other radicals, especially if they were immigrants, to deport them from the United States. Emma Goldman, the famous anarchist, was one of those who was deported. But the 1919-1920 were years of reaction, and 1919 was known as Red Summer of 1919 was known as a number of race riots or anti-black violence in Chicago, along with Texas, Elaine, Arkansas, so on and so forth. So whereas black working people wanted, expected, anticipated an extension of democracy, a restoration of the rights of citizens, which of course would help it in the workplace. Workers who aren't citizens are not going to get a fair shake in the workplace. That's been a given in American history. So black workers, even though on paper, constitutionally they were citizens, have been citizens since 1968 with the ratification of the 14th Amendment. That citizenship was cut back or denied, or most of their rights of being citizenship were denied, especially with the establishment of de jure racism or de jure segregation and discrimination in the 1890s, famously enshrined by Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, a U.S. Supreme Court decision that segregation was constitutional, which meant that in the South, black workers couldn't really get a foothold in many of the industrial firms in the South. Okay, so by 1920, significant numbers of black workers were still agriculturalists, still in the agricultural sector as sharecroppers or tenant farmers. They were land-owning farmers, but their numbers were starting to decrease. Like with all Americans who were farmers, the number of farming people, farming families will start to go into a steady decline from the 1920s to the present. But at the same time, increasing numbers of black workers were getting a toehold or foothold in the urban industrial economy, most famously in the industrial Midwest, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, and all those cities in that area, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, that would be more considered the industrial Northeast. But still, the numbers started to increase. And we began to see them being concentrated in the mass production industries like auto and steel and meat packing, and also some other industries like transportation and mining. But most of them went into the mass production industries because at that point in time, in the 1890s, definitely into the early 1930s, the only major labor organization was the American Federation of Labor. And the American Federation of Labor, even though on a national level, it talks about black and white worker unity, that there shouldn't be discrimination or segregation of black and white workers in unions. Many of the unions that affiliate with the AFL had clauses or bylaws excluding black workers altogether or putting them in segregated locals. Now, some black workers went into the segregated locals if they were craft workers, skilled workers like carpenters, plumbers, electricians, but others, especially the unskilled, formed their own unions and federated with the American Federation of Labor. Federated meaning that these particular unions are not slotted under various unions. They are federated under the headquarters of the American Federation of Labor. So these unions, the point is that despite the stereotype of black workers being strike breakers or anti-unions, there was a steady increase in the number of black workers who want to be unionized. But of course, like all unskilled workers, regardless of color, in the 1920s, they had a hell of a hard time organizing, largely because the American Federation of Labor refused to organize, except with few exceptions, refused to organize unskilled workers, especially those unskilled workers in the mass production and service industries. So but again, I just mentioned strike breaking. I just want to reiterate what I said last week, that like most strike breakers, when black workers did engage in strike breaking, of course, they were desperate for jobs. But black workers generally, not always, but generally, strike against, break strikes by that were conducted by unions that have an active history of segregating or excluding them from jobs or industry. So that's where, black workers did not strike against or break strikes against unions, striking unions that have, were open to black workers. So, and a number of black workers, like I said, formed their own unions and such. The most famous is the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters that was finally organized in 1928, led by the famous socialist, trade unionist, civil rights activist, Asa Philip Randolph, better known as A. Philip Randolph. But Randolph, you know, he was he was really devoted to the trade union cause, and he believed that this is where black Americans generally, black workers specifically, will make breakthroughs towards economic prosperity, towards gaining dignity at work. And the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, for those who are not familiar with that union briefly, the sleeping car porters were men, that was just men at that time, who serviced railroad passengers on the railroad cars, making sure their sleeping quarters were neat and clean, and that the passengers received amenities, so on and so forth. It does fit into the racist stereotypes of what black people are only good for serving white people, but at that time, it was a job, and at that time, they tried to dignify the porters, dignify their work experience. Interestingly, many of the black porters were college graduates, which indicated at that time that many occupations, careers, professions were limited, if not close, to black college graduates. But nonetheless, the thing about the porters being on railroads, it was a good, railroads were everywhere across the United States. Black porters traveled across the United States. They were really a transmission line of information and of news for various black communities across the country. And we will see black porters popping up in many arenas of the civil rights movement in the 1950s, 1960s. For example, just to jump ahead for one moment, the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955, 1956. His last name is Nixon, but I think it's E.D. Nixon. My memory's right now is vague, but he was very important in behind the scenes organizing in Montgomery, and backing up the young minister, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who became the public face leader, the public leader of the Montgomery bus boycott. But many of these porters and their wives and families were very much involved in civil rights activism of one sort or another. In fact, some historians basically make the point or make the argument that the labor movement, especially in the 1930s, 1940s, was definitely a civil rights movement in disguise, or civil rights movement in another form. But the picture for black workers and unionization dramatically improved, unfortunately, during the worst time period in American history as far as employment in the economy was concerned, during the Great Depression. Of course, black people in general, like most Americans, suffered tremendously during the Great Depression. I don't know how many Americans in general starved to death. Of course, many Americans had to hit the bread lines, the soup lines, had to seek relief. And by 1930, the Depression started in October of 1929. But by 1931, it was very clear that private relief organizations, municipal and state relief agencies, just did not have the means, the resources to handle the job of providing relief, keeping people employed, so forth. So the big debate was, should the federal government step in? When Franklin Delano Roosevelt won the election in 1932, he committed the United States government to providing massive work relief, massive economic recovery. Now, of course, Roosevelt, being from the upper class, the patrician class, or the ruling class, whatever you want to call that class, some of his class brethren, like I'm thinking of the DuPont family, for example, openly called him a traitor to his class. They called him a socialist, so on and so forth. But other people said that he saved American capitalism from collapsing into, to prevent the United States from collapsing into a fascism, more than into a socialism. But that's another story. There are some interesting congressional hearings where Marine Corps General Smedley Butler blew the whistle on various elites like the DuPonts and others who wanted to see if a fascist coup d'etat could be engineered in the United States. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But that gives you an idea that Roosevelt had to really rely heavily on working class Americans, on working Americans generally. And various legislation was passed, but the most famous one was the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 that said workers can organize unions and the federal government will at least give workers some protection, some support for union organizing. But the workers had to do the union organizing themselves. Now, some folks, critics have said, well, Roosevelt was not so much pro-union more than he was anti-Great Depression, and he felt that unions would be the way to help to jumpstart the economy, because unions will mean that they'll demand higher wages, demand more jobs, so on and so forth. It's a complex brew. Various arguments they do resonate from one angle or another. But for black workers, for black working people, Roosevelt was seen as basically a savior, because one thing that black working people ran up against as far as work relief, just public welfare relief, so on and so forth, was that they were discriminated against in many of these relief agencies, because the federal government allowed local agencies or allowed local governments to administer relief. And in some places, that administration of relief meant practicing segregation, practicing discrimination. So despite some good intentions on some people within the federal government, the federal government couldn't do everything. So, again, the idea was that working people have to rely on their own steam, their own power. And what happened was when certain individuals, most famously, but John L. Lewis, but others, within the AFL, within the American Federation of Labor, said that they want to really organize mass production workers, the leadership of the AFL, under William Green at that time, didn't want to do that. So Lewis and others broke away from the AFL and in 1936 formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And the Congress of Industrial Organizations leadership made it very clear that all workers in mass production industries, regardless of sex, regardless of color, regardless of race, must be organized in CIO unions. So that was a great breakthrough for black workers. Just to give you an idea, I remember reading somewhere, but I don't know when, within the last 2 or 3 years, that in 1936, at least 100,000 black workers were members of various CIO organizations, be they organizations busily working to organize steel or auto or the rubber industry or the electrical industry or other industries. There were at least 100,000, which was a good chunk of the black population. and a good chunk of the black population that was willing to put their faith into labor unions, despite the history of what the American Federation of Labor did to black workers, to the name of unionism. Generally, many black workers saw the CIO was something different. And even though the Urban League was generally pro-employer in its first few in the first 20 or 30 years, more and more members of the Urban League were coming around to the idea that, yes, and also with the National Association for the Advancement of the Colored People, yes, we should support the CIO because the CIO really does talk about racial equality in the House of Labor. Now, how that gets translated at the locals was a big question mark. It was not translated successfully in every local where there were black workers, significant number of black workers. But nonetheless, the leadership at the national level of the CIO was for racial equality. So much so that by 1940, the number of black workers increased to around 500,000. Now, there are other things going on, too, among black workers. For example, there were organizations like the National Negro Congress, the National Negro Labor Council, that were, leftists in approach, in the sense that whether or not they talk about revolution or socialism, they are very critical of the mainstream labor movement, be it definitely the critical of the AFL and less critical of the CIO. But CIO was not pushing for racial equality as aggressively as those organizations like the National Negro Congress wanted those organizations to do so. Now, black workers, again, in the name of dignity and racial equality at the workplace, so on and so forth, well, we come back to A. Philip Randolph, who noticed, among many other, among most African Americans and white Americans of goodwill, that by 1940, the American industry was revving up again, partly because World War II had begun in Europe. And of course, there was this idea that we should not only maybe supply Great Britain again, like the United States did in World War I, but there were Americans like Franklin Delano Roosevelt who really believed that sooner or later, the United States will be involved in war, and the United States needed to have its industrial production revved up. Also in 1940, when Roosevelt met with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, met with Great Britain's Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, from the Atlantic Charter, they realized that the United States and Great Britain, but especially the United States, had so much industrial capacity that they know they can overwhelm Nazi Germany just on industrial capacity alone, to the point where they believe that they will win the war. The question was, when will they win the war? They, meaning the Allies, will win the war. So when Philip Randolph and others saw that defense industries were not hiring black workers in significant numbers to work the production lines and put them into skill and semi-skilled positions, and some AFL unions were against, the craft unions were still anti-black, still segregationists, or still exclusionists. Randolph and others said, we're going to have a March on Washington, the famous March on Washington movement, to commence or to rally and demonstrate in Washington, D.C. in June of 1941. But it never materialized because Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not want such a demonstration because it would be, partly because it would be propaganda for the Nazis. I mean, Roosevelt made it very clear that the United States will be fighting for democracy if the United States does get involved in the war, which the United States did officially enter the war in December of 1941. But before then, you know, he made it very clear that the United States will be the arsenal for democracy to support the Allied effort, which at that moment was mainly Great Britain against the Nazis. So, you know, he wanted the black working people on his side, fully on his side. They're already part of the Democratic Party coalition, African Americans generally, since 1936, but he still wanted to keep them engaged. He did not want, and other black leaders did not want, a repeat of what happened in World War One, when black working people, or African Americans generally, were not on board with the federal government as far as World War One was concerned. That was true with other ethnic groups as well, Irish Americans, because Great Britain was still the colonial master over Ireland. But so the federal government had to engage in surveillance and sedition acts against dissident Americans, and that would happen again, and that did happen again during World War II, but not on a large scale during World War II as opposed to World War I. Some people say that was because the Japanese bombing of the naval fleet at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii galvanized Americans to be out of their anti-war or isolationist stance and become pro-war, and thus get the Japanese and get those Nazis. Well, at first it was the Japanese, but Roosevelt made sure that the war effort would be geared first to defeat Germany and secondly to defeat Japan. So black workers were involved during the war effort, partly because from the March on Washington movement, Roosevelt made some concessions, namely that federal contracts should go mainly to industries that at least said that they're going to fight racial discrimination or racial segregation at the workplace. And to make sure that would happen, or at least publicize that such efforts are being made, he formed the Fair Employment Practice Commission in 1941, that will last throughout the war, where anyone who has a complaint about discriminatory treatment could do so at the FEPC, and not just black workers, but Jewish workers, Mexican American workers, Asian American workers, who, like Chinese Americans, most Japanese on the West Coast were in internment camps. They had to, if they had complaints about discrimination, they could file it with their nearest FEPC board. So the federal government at least went on record of being pro-civil rights, pro-racial equality. But the problem that Roosevelt had was that the southern wing of the Democratic Party was basically white supremacists and racial segregationists. They weren't going to let go. And that wing of the Democratic Party really remained intact until the 1960s. Some say until after the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was enacted. But for that stretch of time, Roosevelt had to walk very carefully. His New Deal programs before World War II, he had to be careful about how far he pushed the whole idea of racial equality, or let's put aside racial segregation and racial discrimination, because he knew that the southern wing of the Democratic Party and their allies in the elsewhere in the Democratic Party would say, well, let's pull the plug on the New Deal programs. And, of course, the Republican Party was willing to pull the plug on a number of New Deal programs. So during the But when the war came, the nation was basically united. And there's one thing that was made very clear was Gunnar Myrdal, whom I believe it was the Carnegie Foundation that brought, I have to look at my notes, I don't have them in front of me, who brought the Gunnar Myrdal, a Swedish economist and social democrat, over to the United States to study race relations. In 1944, he put out his famous book, American Dilemma. And in that book, he said one of the things that African Americans really wanted was good employment, equal access to good jobs, to be employed. And that was very high on the list of demands by African Americans. So the black workers' movement was moving and moving strong. It would have continued that way if somehow the CIO was able to weather the storm of red baiting that occurred in the labor union movement practically right after the Second World War. The massive strike wave that occurred after World War II, that large massive strike wave, really in 1946, freaked out a number of employers and their allies, freaked out a number of people in Congress, that they passed the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, popularly known as Taft-Hartley, which, of course, some people say it leveled the playing field between unions and management because the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 gave too much power to unions. Maybe, relatively speaking, that may be so, but from what I've seen and what I've read, management still had the final authority, final power. It just meant that management had to get used to the idea that to work with unions, and management still have problems. I had problems in 1947 and still have problems now working with the unions for the most part. So, but anyway, with the Taft-Hartley Act, one of the aims of the Taft-Hartley Act, of course, was to reinforce the idea of what we now call right to work legislation, reinforce the idea that individual employees have rights within their labor unions. So it was designed to weaken unions. And that did not help the CIO when it wanted to organize the South, the last huge bastion of anti-unionism, thanks to the legacies of slavery and the rampant Jim Crow that was still constitutional in the late 1940s. The CIO wanted to start Operation Dixie to organize black workers. And, of course, black workers really wanted that desperately. That didn't happen. And the red baiting that began in the labor movement, noticeably by 1947, 1948, well, whatever we have to say about communists and socialists, Communist Party, Socialist Workers' Party, and others who think in those directions but not members of the Communist Party of the United States of America or the Socialist Party of the United States of America, the Socialist Workers' Party, excuse me, whatever we think of them, they were busy organizing workers, and some of them were very good at what they were doing, that they were elected officers of the union locals, and I think in a few national unions, like the electrical, not the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the United Electrical Workers, that's a long name, but United UE, had known or some communist members, Communist Party members, or at least people who were friendly with the Communist Party in many of these union positions. And what happened was that for the CIO to save itself, and of course to save itself from the relentless attack from the American Federation of Labor, many workers, black and white, who were identified as communists, reds, pinkos, whatever. Either they were told to shut up and put up, stop doing what you're doing, or they were fired from their jobs outright. So the union movement really weakened itself. Yes, there were external pressures and terrible external pressures, but if the leadership was willing to really fight, go to jail. Well, some people would dispute me on that, so I won't go any further. I just think that maybe more effort would have to be exerted to overcome those horrible external pressures that weighed in on the labor union movement to keep at least their militant workers. Because if John L. Lewis relied on Communist Party and Socialist Workers' Party's members to help organize workers back in 1936, 37, 38, 39, the union's leadership of the late 1940s, early 1950s shouldn't have let them go by. But of course, part of the problem was that the federal government, with its labor relations legislation, like the National Labor Relations Act, and President Truman, who was pro-labor, meant that the labor movement had powerful friends in the federal government, and you shouldn't bite the hand that supports you or bite the hand that feeds you. And so it was a complicated mess. What I'm getting at is that when we hear about Martin Luther King Jr. being called a communist or communist sympathizer, or one of his closest advisors, Stan Levinson, in the early 1960s, was communist or communist sympathizer or former Communist Party member, whatever the charge was, or the charges were, there's a history there where the people who really, among white people, who really fought very hard for civil rights or racial equality, many of them, not all of them, but many of them happened to be leftists of some sort. And for black working people, what happened to them was that when the left was basically purged out of the labor union movement, and the moderates, and of course, when I say left and right and moderate, I'm just using the textbook examples. I question that type of paradigm, but anyway, be that as it may, those people who are traditionally considered right, on the right of the political spectrum, on the moderate sections of the political spectrum within the labor movement, they weren't that gung-ho for civil rights because, well, they have to play games with the federal government and with other groups in the United States. I mean, they had to think of survival of the unions even as early as the 1950s, when the labor movement represented maybe one out of three adult workers. At that time, nothing was guaranteed that the labor movement would remain strong. And sure enough, hindsight is 2020 vision. We saw that the labor movement started to lose ground in the 1960s in terms of membership, in terms of political power, so on and so forth. Still a force, but not like it was back in the late 30s, 1940s. And very early 1950s. Black workers were left with church groups, which of course many of them were closely affiliated with, but the leadership of the civil rights movement gravitated more toward the churches, more towards secular people. Someone like A. Philip Randolph, who was already in the labor movement, already the trade unionist, and he would be elected as one of the executive vice presidents of the American Federation of Labor and the AFL-CIO, the two organizations, AFL and the CIO, merge in 1955. So Randolph will become one of the executive vice presidents of the AFL-CIO, I think in 1957. But Randolph will be one of those few black labor leaders who was really not into the church scene as far as leadership was concerned, but he was well-respected. He had a history behind him, a track record. He will remain a force within among black workers within the black community. But the new crop of black leaders in the 1950s, 1960s, were not tied to the labor movement. Some of them were sympathetic to the labor movement, like Martin Luther King Jr., was sympathetic to labor, but he would become more so as the 1960s unfolded. But there were other aspects of the African-American freedom struggle that weren't sympathetic to the labor movement. Yes, they support black workers, but only as black workers, not as workers. In other words, to form alliances with non-black workers was frowned upon in, among some sectors of the African-American freedom struggle. So, let's see now. Time is... Oh, my God, I'm running out of time. Okay, so let's fast forward. I mentioned much earlier Nixon, who was a port, who was a railroad porter, who was with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who was instrumental in helping to organize the Montgomery bus boycott, along with other local people, including a very active women's community, women's organization in Black Montgomery. And that type of relationship panned out in a number of other areas. Other black communities. And even though I didn't talk much about black agriculturalists, sharecroppers, tenant farmers in particular, they too were not unfamiliar with the idea of unions, organizing unions. We can go back to 1919. Robert Hill, who organized the Progressive Farmers and the Household Union of America in the South, primarily in the Mississippi Delta, in Arkansas and Mississippi. Well, again, to organize sharecroppers, farm laborers, tenant farmers, to have their rights, to fight for their rights, to fight for higher wages. Well, that union was destroyed during the course of the famous, some people's say the riots, but it was more like massacre. We don't know how many dozens, if not several hundred, black persons were killed in the area around in the Mississippi Delta, centering around Elaine, Arkansas, in 1919. But that's an example where the black agriculturists wanted unions, and they know that the planters, the plantation owners, would play hardball. Actually, they'll become venomous murderers to stop unionization. That didn't happen to black and some white sharecroppers and tenant farmers in the Tar Heel section of Missouri in the 1930s when they organized unions. There was the Southern Tenant Farmers, Farm Workers Union in the Deep South as well. And they did some, they made some success, but for the most part, they didn't get very far. But the idea of unions, going into unions, remained relatively strong among black working people. And it was becoming very clear, it was very clear on the famous march to Washington in 1963 that labor leaders like Walter Reuther and A. Philip Randolph joined forces with the non-labor section of the civil rights movement, like Martin Luther King Jr. and Whitney Young, John L. Lewis, on that march to on Washington, and you notice when you look back at the newsreels and the photographs of that march, many of the demonstrators said that they want freedom and they want jobs. So there's the economic component. Many labor union members were involved in helping to organize the march, so on and so forth. And, of course, A. Philip Randolph, he was the mastermind of the 1963 March on Washington. So, in a sense, he realized his dream of actually having a march based on his March on Washington movement of 1941. We see an organic relationship developing, strengthening during the course of the 1960s. And Martin Luther King Jr. represented a major leader or lightning rod or figurehead or some symbol of a person who wanted to make this connection between the civil rights movement and the labor union movement loud and clear for all to know. And his involvement with the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis, Tennessee, showed that Martin Luther King Jr. was committed to the idea of a labor civil rights coalition, not only for black workers, but for all workers. Of course, that will lead into his idea of the Poor People's March, that this should be a coalition of poor or low-income Americans of all colors to fight for their rights and to fight for economic improvements in this country. King was very much pro-labor, pro-labor union.
Oh, we'll leave there for today.
Oh, my goodness, I was going to talk about the revolutionary.
We have yet another installment to go, so we can do that. But also, I want the audience to know that part of the next program will be, of course, their questions, and I hope that all along, because we've been asking them to, you know, listen carefully so that when Q&A comes, and that would be in the next segment, that, you know, you'll be ready to take their questions as well.
Okay, so, I'll make it very quick next time.
Oh, this is great stuff. The reason
leave it open.
Being, I see that, you know, listening to the story that you're telling us, the lecture that you're giving us, we're seeing the main story that is occurring to me is the fight, the constant fight to validate and to validate the value of labor and who shall own your labor. I mean, that's the issue to me.
That has been an ongoing issue. That is correct.
And that African Americans have a unique history to tell with respect to this question. So, especially here in the United States, but all around the world, but in the United States, since we're talking about U.S. history here, this is a very, very extraordinary insight into the lengths to which they had to go to protect the value of their labor and to own their labor. Very
that
interesting.
That is correct. That
so
is
I want to thank
correct.
You so much, Professor Lumpkins, for being with us.
Well, thank you for your patience.
Segments. Oh, this is great stuff. We could go on for as long as you need to. But
I know. Usually in the classroom, I can go slowly and work things out and work off the students, bounce ideas off the students. But in this format, I feel I have to rush, clip, clip, clip.
But don't feel like you have to rush. We'll continue until you're done. How about that?
Okay. I'll make next week the last installment.
But don't feel that pressure. We'll talk. So we will get you to say exactly what you have to offer, and this is the value. You are offering us a gift, and we want to honor that. So thank you so much for being with us today. And
well, thank you very much again.
And we'll talk right after the program and get our gears in play here for the next go-round. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Right here on PRN.FM, coming up next, The Infectious Mind, Myth, sorry, with David Crowe, not mine, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lead. Always important to hear from you as to how you're reacting to these programs, whether they are benefiting you, whether you're finding value in them. So you can drop me a line and let me know. Thank you so much. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye. That's got his own.
Thanks, Billy.